You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, Chinese satellite experiments bring a global quantum internet a step closer.
In my plan or in our vision, we hope such a technology can be practical in the next 5 to 10 years.
What quantum clocks could tell us about the nature of space, time, and gravity?
So I would like to be able to say how would the ticking of these quantum clocks and its precision be affected by the underlying space-time. And these things could have important applications in, for example, clocks in satellites.
A big bang in a little room. The quest to create a baby universe in a particle accelerator.
Actually, the energy is not so much. There is a finite amount of energy that you can, from which you can build an infinite universe.
And YouTube is alive with the sound of physics.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
After a bit of a break, we're pleased to welcome you back to the Foundational Questions Institute podcast.
Yes, we've been missing for the better part of a year. But the good news is that, in our absence, physicists have been working hard to come up with new experiments and theories to pack out the podcast. And we have a bit of a quantum gravity theme lined up for you today, as our contributors explore what satellite experiments, tests with quantum clocks on Earth, and even making baby universes in a particle accelerator can tell us about uniting the rules of the very small, quantum theory, with the cosmic laws of Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity.
Take FQXI member and quantum physicist Jianhui Pan of the University of Science and Technology of China in Hefei, for instance. Just a year ago, in August 2016, as keen listeners may remember, China launched the world's first space satellite dedicated to quantum research.
Since then, Pan and his colleagues have used that satellite to test the limits of entanglement, the weird quantum phenomenon that links particles together so that measurements carried out on one immediately changes the properties of its partners. By firing photons of light back and forth from the ground to the satellite, Pan's team has set a new record for the distance that entanglement has been demonstrated to hold.
And this month, the team announced they had achieved the first experimental step to setting up a global ultra-secure quantum communications network. Earlier, Zia spoke with Pan about the team's successes, how soon he thinks an unhackable quantum internet could be in place, and how China's satellite may be used to test the foundations of physics and models of quantum gravity.
A year ago, in August 2016, China launched the world's first quantum space satellite, named Mysius, in honor of an ancient Chinese philosopher. Over the past few months, a team of Chinese researchers has used the satellite to break distance records for entanglement, showing that particles can maintain quantum links across space. In June, the team reported in the journal Science that entanglement was preserved in pairs of photons sent by Mysius to ground stations separated by over 1,200 kilometers. And in August, the team reported in the journal Nature that they had sent an unbreakable quantum cipher between the satellite and the ground. The team is led by quantum physicist Jianhui Pan of the University of Science and Technology of China in Hefei, who says that the satellite has two goals. Firstly, the team has a fundamental aim to test the limits of quantum phenomena, which apply to microscopic objects, across previously unheard of distances.
Because we know, anomaly and quantum mechanics and relate to, in most of time, to the microscopic object. So, and one open question is how, the theory can work properly and even over large distance or over large scale.
The team's second goal is to lay the foundations for a quantum internet to enable ultra-secure communications around the globe. Such a network would use quantum cryptography to encrypt messages so that they are unhackable.
So the second motivation of our satellite is to investigate the possibility to perform large-scale quantum communication. So, I mean, one of the nice solutions to achieve long-distance transmission of a quantum signal is to explore the free space channel. So in this way, by using or by developing and using, satellite in free space, we can achieve both missions. So that's the main motivation to launch the satellite.
Quantum cryptography allows ultra-secure communications between users. That's because any attempt to eavesdrop on a message will disturb the transmission, sounding an alert. It has already been successfully demonstrated on the ground and is even in use by some commercial companies. Such secure communications can be encoded in entangled photons that are usually transmitted through optical fibers. But there is a limit to how far these fibers can stretch before the signal becomes too weak to be viable. These weak signals cannot be boosted because amplifying them would destroy their quantum coding. As Pan explains, this limits optical fiber-based transmissions to distances of just a few hundred kilometers.
All formal realization of quantum cryptography is limited up to a few hundred kilometers. Because the quantum signal cannot be amplified during the propagation in the fiber, so then, the maximum distance of quantum key distribution or quantum cryptography in fiber is limited to the order of 100 kilometers. So normally such a technology is only useful for intra-city secure communication. But if we really, really want to make such technology useful, then we have to explore the distance and to the global scale.
By successfully distributing a quantum key between the satellite and the ground, the team has shown that a global communications network is feasible. But there's still a long way to go before a quantum internet becomes commonplace. Up to now, the team has transmitted photons in the evening, where there is less noise from photons in sunlight. So one of the first problems Pan says that they need to solve is how to send transmissions during the day.
So the first thing we need to overcome is to make sure the satellite can work in daytime. Because during the day, the sunlight will cause a lot of trouble. Because the sunlight also contains many single photons, and which will contribute a lot of noise, so that our satellite can only work at a percent during the evening. So that's one thing we need to solve. And also, we already developed some technology and also performed ground tests in which we show it's also possible to perform quantum key distribution in daylight.
The team also only has a short time window in which to transmit to the satellite because it is in low Earth orbit. To increase this time window, they plan to launch a high orbit satellite. Pan.
So the second thing is, and our current satellite is a low orbital satellite, so every day we only have one chance to pass through one specific ground station, and such that makes an efficiency very lower. So every day probably we only have a few hundred seconds we can perform a quantum key distribution. So currently we are considering to launch a high orbital satellite, so the communication time can be significantly increased.
Pan predicts that the technology will become more practical in the next 5 to 10 years as China launches more satellites to create a quantum satellite constellation.
Because we have some long-term plan, and within 5 years, we are going to launch one or two or probably several satellites. So some will be in low orbital, so one will be in high orbital. So in this way, we can construct the so-called quantum satellite constellation to make our solution much more efficient. So according to our current knowledge, we are confident within 5 years, it could already used, for example, by some bank. So in my plan or in our vision, we hope such a technology can be practical in the next 5 to 10 years.
In addition to the hoped-for practical applications, such tests may also allow quantum physicists to learn more about fundamental science. Pan-satellite may also open the door to testing theories that attempt to unite quantum physics with Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. Many proposed quantum gravity models predict that space-time is grainy on tiny scales. If so, photons travelling from the satellite may be slightly disturbed en route to Earth, causing their polarizations to change. Pan explains how this polarization shift might be picked up in their lab on the ground.
As long as we manage to distribute a single photon over large distance, we can somehow, by measuring and the tiny change of the polarization of single photon, and we can test the various model of quantum gravity. So in this way, we can pursue lots of things in the field of quantum foundation and the test of special relativity and investigating of quantum gravity model and so on.
Pan-satellite to Earth experiments have already set an entanglement distance record through space. But he wants to go further, and with the help of another Chinese space project, Pan is now shooting for the moon.
So then, which means if we want to perform an ultimate test, we need to distribute entanglement over, for example, 300,000 kilometers. Then in the future, I think we also have a planning, because by combining the moon project onto investigation in China, and we want to see the possibility in future to achieve distribution of entanglement and between moon and Earth.
Thank you to Jianwei Pan for chatting with Zia. You can read more about China's ascendancy in the quantum space race in an article that Zia wrote for Nature, which we're linking to on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
We're also linking to a paper about another quantum communications milestone. While Pan has been exploring space, in August, quantum physicist Tianmin Jin of the University of Shanghai and his colleagues also reported the first demonstration that entanglement between photons can survive over a distance of 36 kilometers in seawater. Jin told me that the work will have applications for the military in particular, because it will help set up secure quantum communications to underwater vehicles. Their experiment, which was carried out in the Yellow Sea, is described in Optics Express.
Now, if you think a space satellite is far too long a way to go to test quantum gravity, and would prefer something a bit closer to home, then you may want to chat with quantum physicist and FQXI member Yvette Fuentes from the University of Vienna in Austria and Nottingham University in the UK.
Like Pan, Fuentes and her colleagues are also fascinated by uniting quantum theory with gravity. But she and her colleagues have taken a more down-to-earth approach, looking at quantum tests that are already up and running in ground-based labs, for instance, and seeing how adding in the effects of a changing gravitational field changes their results. It sounds like a modest task, but, as Fuentes explained to Brendan earlier, it could help physicists both develop new technologies and profoundly change our understanding of space-time.
I like to have these two ingredients, sort of the technology on one hand and the fundamental questions in the other hand.
Yvette Fuentes is a quantum physicist at the University of Nottingham in the UK, and currently a visiting professor at the University of Vienna in Austria. She is intrigued by the nature of quantum gravity, the as-yet unknown theory that will hopefully tie the quantum microworld to our laws of gravity, Einstein's general relativity.
The main one would be that we can test it in experiments. I mean, I used to do a lot of work, which was just academic. I was just curious about things. But now, in the last years, I have been really focusing on thinking about things that could be, in principle, tested in experiments nowadays. Then I wanted my projects to have very deep questions. So I like a part of it just to be fundamental questions, understanding the universe just per se. But I have found that that doesn't need to be in a fight with applications and technology. Usually, on the contrary, most of the time I can find in my work these both aspects that I can develop together.
Most quantum gravity researchers try to construct quantum gravity from the ground up. String theory, loop quantum gravity, they try to invent the whole thing from some basic principles. But Fuentes and her colleagues want to go about it in a more focused, strategic way. They want to start with some things we already know a lot about, such as measuring a quantum thing, and they want to imagine making some relatively small changes, like measuring that quantum thing while it moves in a gravitational field. What happens when we make these changes? What new details can we see? Possibly something useful, possibly something deep. The project revolves around the idea of observers. The nature of observers is totally different in quantum mechanics and in general relativity.
Right, so in quantum mechanics, well, observers affect the system that they measure because at some point the observer makes a decision to make a measurement or not. And then when the observer makes a measurement, the observer chooses what measurement operator to apply. And then when the observer takes that decision, it affects the future evolution of the system. But then if you think about observers in general relativity, in that case, the observers, when they make a measurement, they don't affect the system, just in classical general relativity. However, the universe that they observe, or the physics they observe, depends on their state of motion.
The curious thing, then, is what is the right way to think about an observer? The right way to describe the observer's role in the overlap between quantum mechanics and general relativity? Fuentes will take on this question with the help of an $84,000 grant from FQXI and two colleagues, David Edward Bruschi from the University of York in the UK, and Stefano Mancini at the University of Camerino in Italy. As a team, they bring a wide range of talents to this bridge-building project. Bruschi describes himself and Fuentes as the quantum field side of the project. That is, the people who study high-energy particle collisions, interactions, and so on. And then Mancini as the quantum information side, which involves the study of the uses of quantum mechanics in computing, cryptology, and now, of course, gravity. The team plans to describe the nature of observers using modern techniques from quantum metrology.
Metrology is the science of making measurements, and of course, we need to measure very precisely things like time, magnetic field strengths, gravitational field strengths, any really physical quantity that you can think of. So we need to be able to measure physical quantities of interest in a very precise way. Quantum metrology would be to do so, but exploiting quantum properties that will allow you to estimate these properties in a way that would be, say, going beyond what you can do with classical methods.
The team will follow two main lines of questioning. Does metrology show us something we've missed about past gravity measurements? And does including gravity tell us anything we haven't known yet about quantum measurements? For the first question, the team will start by looking at measurements of the cosmic microwave background, or CMB. The CMB is the swamp of radiation filling our universe, left over from the Big Bang. Astronomers have learned huge amounts about our universe by studying the CMB in increasingly precise detail. The big question is, how precise can you get? The team wants to find out how the famous quantum uncertainty combines with gravity-induced expansion of our universe to limit our ultimate ability to pick out details in that CMB, which will ultimately limit astronomers' ability to pin down the features of the universe. Fuentes herself will concentrate on a second question: how does gravity impact quantum metrology? To answer this, the team will think about clocks. And they will do it in a way that brings together the two ingredients Fuentes mentioned earlier, practical uses and deep questions.
In particular, in this project, I would like to find out if quantum mechanics imposes fundamental limitations in the way that we measure space and time. And I would say, yes, I think so, but I would like to be able to say more about it and quantify it and say how this happened. So that would be the fundamental questions. And then the applications would be that you could turn this into a very precise clock that is compatible with general relativity. So I would like to be able to say how would like the ticking of these quantum clocks and its precision be affected by the underlying space-time. And these things could have important applications in, for example, clocks in satellites.
Fuentes, Brusky, and Mancini think trying to combine immediate applications and deep ideas is important, not just for finding research funds, but for leading you to worthy and curious questions. What can you actually do with the big ideas? And what deep truths can you learn from thinking about the way real things actually work?
The main thing for me is that we have, on one hand, in quantum mechanics, very precise clocks. Then on the other hand, in general relativity, we have these notions of clocks as point-like systems. And then you can think about this clock moving in space-time, and you have then the notion of proper time. But there hasn't been a model yet for a clock that brings together quantum mechanics and general relativity. That doesn't exist. We can't make a clock be point-like. It always has to have a physical extension. And then once you have this extension, this clock is really a physical system. If I request this physical system to be a clock, how does the curvature of the space-time, or how does, you know, relativistic effects affect the ticking of the clock? And learn for the first time some quantum effects in time dilation and so on. Yeah, that is the kind of questions that I find very interesting and that we're hoping to answer. And we're already getting some very interesting results. Okay. I'm like very excited about it.
That was Yvette Fuentes speaking with Brendan. You can read more about her research in an article that Brendan wrote on our website, www.fqxi.org/community.
Now, as lab-based experiments go, it's hard to think of one that's more ambitious than that proposed by our next guest, FQXI member and cosmologist Eduardo Grendelman of Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. Over the past 30 years, Grendelman and colleagues have been on a quest to generate a whole new cosmos in a particle accelerator. That's right, a baby universe, which would grow from a tiny particle called a monopole until it reaches astronomical proportions, maybe cosmological proportions, and can house its own stars, galaxies, and maybe even life. It's a project that Zia has been following for a few years.
Indeed, it's a topic that's close to my heart because the Baby Universe Project is the subject of my new popular physics book, A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes. In June, Gwendolyn and I were invited to the Physics Days conference at the University of the Eastern Mediterranean in northern Cyprus, where Gwendolyn was the keynote speaker and spoke about the idea. At the end of the meeting, in a rather noisy hotel lobby, I asked Gwendolyn to say a few words for the podcast about the mechanics of how you can grow your infant cosmos in a particle accelerator and how his speculative theory might help those trying to construct a theory of quantum gravity. But before diving into that, I asked Gwendolyn a pressing question that has concerned a lot of readers when they hear the topic of my book. That is, if we grow a baby universe in a particle accelerator in a lab on Earth, is there a danger that it might explode outwards into our cosmos, destroying our planet and everything else in its path as this bubble of newly made space inflates ever outwards?
Well, in fact, it was surprising. First of all, there is a solution, which is important, but the solution was kind of very intriguing because the bubble can indeed increase exponentially and become infinite, but it doesn't expand towards the environment, so to speak. You have to use the full extension of the space which contains a wormhole. So by using the wormhole solution of the space, the expansion can take place, but the universe, the radius of the bubble can become big, but expanding towards the other side of the, forming a wormhole, yeah, that eventually disconnects from the outside.
Gwendolyn is describing how he and his colleagues stumbled on the idea that you could create a baby universe in a particle accelerator some 30 years ago. As a starting ingredient, you would need a bubble filled with a special type of vacuum called false vacuum that would be primed to inflate. We'll come back in a moment to just where you might find this false vacuum seed in reality. At the time, Gwendolyn was a PhD student at MIT, working with cosmologist Alan Guth and others. They realised that if you fired particles with enough energy at a tiny false vacuum bubble, it would start to grow. But as it did so, it would warp space-time, inverting it to create a wormhole connecting our universe to the growing baby cosmos. The tiny baby universe would then grow to epic scales, but in a space-time that was separated from ours, connected to us through this wormhole. The wormhole tunnel would eventually itself pinch closed, disconnecting us from our child cosmos. The team was stunned to find that such a universe-making feat was possible, at least in theory. But they were also aware that there were immense hurdles to actually achieving this in practice. For starters, it would take a particle accelerator with more energy than the Large Hadron Collider has today. And it seemed to require the impossible. They would need to create the kind of Big Bang singularity, the infinitely small dense point of energy that birthed our own cosmos, in the lab.
Concerning the practicality of the idea, there are some obstacles to this idea because the solutions that we found actually involve an initial singularity. So basically, if you wanted to do this in the laboratory, you should avoid that initial singularity.
It's basically like asking us to have a real Big Bang in the sense that we had a Big Bang at the beginning of our universe, but to create that, all that kind of rush of energy from this kind of tiny, tiny, infinitely dense point, and that would take such a huge amount of energy, it doesn't seem like something we could really do in the lab.
Actually, the energy is not so much. There is a finite amount of energy that you can, from which you can build an infinite universe. And the Big Bang is that you have to use to make this child universe is localized. It's a point like Big Bang.
The energy requirement, while huge, wasn't a deal breaker. But Gwendolyn was worried about the need for a singularity. The search for an alternative seed from which to grow a baby universe without needing a singularity has occupied him over the decades.
Then we work over the years, and I work over the years on different models to avoid this singularity. One possibility was to use quantum effects. Another possibility that was explored by a Japanese group is to use a magnetic monopoles, that somehow you avoid some theorems, singularity theorems. So there are ways around.
So there are ways around it, and part of what I do in the book is explore one of them in particular, the one that you mentioned by the Japanese group, where if you could find a magnetic monopole, which is a hypothetical particle that physicists have good reason to believe exists but haven't yet discovered, but perhaps if you could find one of them, you could create your own universe inside a laboratory.
Yeah. Well, let me say that the magnetic monopole is a particularly interesting example because at the center of the magnetic monopole, you kind of already have a false vacuum bubble. You could see without looking very much on the technical thing that this has a potential for being used for this idea. And then these Japanese colleagues studied some kind of perturbations from which you can grow this little bubble inside and make out from this a real universe, a false vacuum bubble that expands to infinity.
So let me ask you a couple of questions that have come up from the public since I wrote my book. People are quite excited about this, and they've sort of been asking questions like, you know, is there a way that we could prop open the wormhole tunnel and maybe travel into the universe? You know, could we get things from the universe? Could we tweak the laws of physics so that we could control the kind of properties inside the universe, the forces, the particles, things like that? So it's really a question of how much control would we have if we were in the future able to make such a baby universe?
Yeah, the simpler solutions will not have this property. Only at the beginning you will be able to see the universe, but then when the universe starts to expand, it just really disconnects. What you would have to have is use a wormhole that's what is called transversible wormholes. They're hard to get in the classical theory of gravity. They may appear through quantum effects or by violating the energy conditions. So to get in touch with the other universes, it may not be so easy, so to speak.
And just to be clear, we're talking really kind of speculative stuff now, you know, the kind of things where, you know, if you want to see that kind of traversable wormhole, you maybe have to go to Kip Thorne's movie Interstellar or something like that to see how people who have thought about it have kind of thought about ways that this could be realized and use that for a science fiction scenario. You know, it's still this incredible idea. So let me ask you, you know, you sound very calm about it, but does it, I mean, oh, he's giggling now in the background, but, you know, are you really excited about this prospect actually happening one day?
Well, I'm not too nervous about it because I don't think we will be able to make a baby universe in my lifetime, but...
But let me ask you, even if it's something that we can't do in your lifetime, you know, produce it ourselves, generate it as human beings, is it something that maybe could be happening spontaneously or naturally? Because we hear talk about the multiverse, this idea that there are many other universes out there like our own, which also comes from inflation theory, but maybe by a slightly different mechanism. But is this something where, you know, is this another way that perhaps universes could be being born around us?
Yeah, actually, it could be a process that could be taking place in the vacuum of quantum gravity, for example.
Physicists have struggled for decades to come up with a theory of quantum gravity that would bring together the quantum rules that govern the behavior of particles on microscopic scales with the laws of gravity on cosmic scales set out by Einstein with his theory of general relativity, which describes the motion of planets and stars. One issue is that when physicists try to combine the mathematics from the two theories together, they get hit by seemingly nonsensical results. The solutions to their new equations give them infinite answers, telling them that space-time's fabric should be ripping itself apart. Since this clearly doesn't happen, many of those theories of quantum gravity were thought to be wrong. But it would be very handy for such quantum gravity models if the pesky infinities that they throw out could be shrouded away somehow, so that they didn't make such catastrophic predictions for how our space-time should behave. Could hiding them away in baby universes that disconnect from our own space-time be the answer? Gwendolyn.
I thought this could have applications to make a consistent quantum gravity, because there's very high energy excitation, which are the ultraviolet sector of the theory that causes all the problems. They have a high probability, apparently, to disconnect from us. So you could be pushing out the bad part of the theory, and maybe it can help to make a consistent quantum gravity. So that's a theoretical idea. They could help to make a nice quantum gravity theory by making a use of child units, as you say, spontaneous processes that do not require intervention of human intervention, that certainly should be happening.
Right, so I think I've sort of asked you everything that I wanted to ask you. I mean, we've gone through, you know, this kind of crazy, wild idea that you've been working on for some decades of how to make a universe in a laboratory, but also you know, if the model is correct, how maybe these could be spontaneously created, and that could help us understand quantum gravity in a way. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, well, let's hope that we can make a baby universe sometime. And also that we will know that we did it, right?
That was Eduardo Gwendolman chatting to Zia. And of course, if you want to read more about the project, there is a link to Zia's book, A Big Bang in a Little Room, published by Basic Books, on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. As well as a link to an online game to have a go at making your own baby universe too. I read this book and I loved it, and part of what's so interesting was the way that you're able to talk about what motivates the people doing the science, including their religious motivations. It felt like you got them to actually be honest about what they were thinking. And also these questions that they think about, like this big one, like, is it okay to create a baby universe? Is that good or bad? I mean, that's a fascinating question, I think, and to show that these people are actually thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. I mean, I guess, you know, one thing we know, because we work at FQXI and we spend a lot of time with all of these people, is how really interesting they are as, you know, personalities, just, you know, laughing and joking and, you know, thinking about things beyond physics. And I was trying to bring some of that out, I guess, you know, when I was speaking to them. So it wasn't just about the physics of, you know, how you can make a baby universe, but it was really trying to explore what drives these people, you know, why they're so fascinated with physics and these other big questions. And yeah, like you say, you know, does it touch on ideas from religion, from philosophy, from ethics? Because we're talking about, you know, a huge idea. So yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed the book. And finally, if all this chatter about making DIY universes has left your head spinning, now's the time to chill out and put on some music.
The cat is dead.
Physics-based music, of course.
Come back at the end of time. There's a brain on the mat floating around.
FQXI member and physicist Sabine Hossenfelder has long dabbled in songwriting and performing. Now, with the help of an FQXI mini grant, she's produced 3 physics music videos. So how easy is it to come up with ideas for songs, inject some science, and then shoot the videos? Brendan caught up with Hossenfelder to find out.
So I was trying to think of a place where we would actually see some green plants, and Apo suggested that we would meet in Crete, and he promised it wouldn't be warm even in the winter. Turned out to be it's the coldest winter in Crete for 30 years or something. And it actually started hailing while I was on the beach. So it was not cozy in the flimsy dress that I'm wearing, but we did get some green trees.
Physicist Sabine Hossenfelder is no stranger to writing physics-inspired music and creating her own videos to go along with it. Sure, her songs are educational, but they are also just good songs on their own terms, with inspiration from physics ideas that feels natural and unforced.
The cat is dead.
Like Schrödinger's cat, we will all be dead and still alive.
The cat is dead.
She produced her latest set of 3 music videos, up now on YouTube, with the help of an FQXI mini grant. Hossenfelder says these 3 songs were deliberate attempts to write physics songs, but that's not always the case.
Well, I usually write songs to clear my brain of physics stuff. You know, when I'm stuck with some topic and I have to think of something else, I write a song. It sometimes happens that it turns out to be about physics. It happens more often than not, but it's not something that I usually do.
In the past, Hossenfelder has filmed and produced her own videos. For this project, she had the help of videographer
Apostolos Vasilidis, himself a former physicist, and a recording engineer, Timu Aldo. The team met to brainstorm song topics and video ideas, recorded the music in a studio in Stockholm, Sweden, and filmed the videos at moody sites around Stockholm and in the middle of a hailstorm on a shockingly cold beach on the island of Crete. One way that Hassenfelder kept the songs from feeling like a physics lesson is by avoiding physics jargon in the lyrics. Instead, each of the videos ends with a short spoken explanation from her about the physics ideas behind the song.
See, I don't like to put too much heavy science terminology in the lyrics themselves, because most often it comes out awkward. I like to be a little bit vague, so that you don't necessarily have to interpret it in a sciencey way. You can also get out a story from the lyrics without the physics interpretation. So I was trying to separate the science theme part from the actual lyrics. It's also that a lot of these technical words are actually pretty much impossible to sing.
Hassenfelder will continue making music videos, even if she has to manage the filming herself.
The thing is that I can't be both behind the camera and in front of the camera. It works badly. I've tried to decohere, but it didn't really work.
Thanks to Sabine Hassenfelder for chatting with Brendan. You'll find links to her videos, which are all rather good, on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Hassenfelder's day job also fits very much with the theme of a number of items on the podcast today. If you want to know more about that, we're also linking to an article and podcast interview featuring Hassenfelder's own search for signs of quantum gravity, Wrinkles in Spacetime, by reporter Colin Stewart.
That's all we have time for today. So thank you once more to Junhui Pan, Yvette Fuentes, Eduardo Gwendolman, and Sabine Hassenfelder.
As always, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter @fqxi.
Thank you for listening. He's been Brendan Foster.
She's been Zia Morali.
And this is Sabine Hassenfelder with Catching Light.
Well, I'm off to fling myself back and forth between Earth and a low-orbit quantum satellite.
And I'm off to sing about making a new universe.